Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 5:35 British Summer Time. Well, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But before we get into the longer-term themes, let's have a look at what's been happening in the markets here today. I suppose the two big news stories are first that Japan finally rose interest rates. Possibly, well, really only by a quarter of a point, which isn't an awful lot, but this is a major policy shift, first rate rise in 6 years, and the last time they rose rates was in the summer of 2000, which really was not the right thing to do, given that you had this massive stock market correction in full swing. And politicians in particular were really quite nervous of the fact that they were going to raise interest rates, but the economy is looking quite good, and that quote from Fuki saying that they're going to wait and see how things go before any further interest rates. What we can be absolutely sure of is that the pace of rises is going to be very slow, and that the chances of it going very higher are practically nil. I think 1% would be the absolute upper limit of where they're going to go, and again, that is remarkably low by any reality check. The other thing that's happening here is you have this terrible political tension going on in the Middle East, and that is certainly helping to push up the oil price. Oil is currently sitting at 77.40. It was as high as 78.40. That's on the August contract. It was as high as 78.40 earlier on in the session, but pegged back a bit, and it's been sort of trading between sort of 70 and 120 most of the day. That's up on the day. Some other interesting things happening here. Well, because you have this, you have oil pushing up, and you have geopolitical tensions, and people are in a flap about the Middle East and about North Korea, and you have the G8 summit and coming up. And people are sort of getting a little bit wary of what Russia is doing of Russia using their energy deposits as a political weapon. Well, all of these things are starting to hit stock markets, particularly the fact that you do have, I mean, we are in an interest rate rising cycle, and this has started to hit ha started to be factored into equity pricing. So the Dow Jones is currently down 1%, and the Nasdaq is almost down 1%, down nearly 20 points. Across the board in Europe, almost everything closed down 1% or over. The FTSE was down exactly 1%, down 57 points, and the DAX was down nearly 2% at 105 points. Of the major indices, Australia really did have a rather bad day in here today. It was down 118 points or 2.3%. But the key to looking at these markets, of course, just before I say anything, the Nikkei was down 1 2/3%, down 252 points, helped on the way by the higher oil prices and by the rising of interest rates. But the key here is that while just about every other market on the way up was leading the US, it's actually the US is leading now on the way down. And that leads us into our sort of longer term themes, because we hold that the US is in a secular bear market, which is a generational long period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And what that means is that we had this massive expansion of valuations and contraction of dividend yields leading up to the spike and the bubble in the Nasdaq, which burst in 2000. Now, since then, people are starting to get more used to getting better value. So they want to pay less and get more. That means that they want lower valuations, higher dividend yields. And over the progress of a secular bear market, you will see dividend yields starting to rise and PE ratios starting to contract. At the bottom of the last bear market, the S&P yielded over 6%. Right now, it's less than 2%, so there's still really rather a long way to go. And importantly, because the US is leading on the downside here, it means that when that starts to bottom, the other markets, which are largely high beta, just about every market is going to be a high beta or have a large degree of beta relative to the US, will probably rally quite significantly. But what we're seeing right now is that the first area of potential support for the Europeans and the Asian markets is going to be those June lows, whereas the Nasdaq has already taken them out. It would be interesting to see that once these Europeans get back to their mid-June lows, where the US markets are going to be. Because while we could say that the European markets and some of the Asian markets are probably not going to make significant new lows, or they're most of the way through their correction, we can't really say that for the US because having the Nasdaq haven't broken its lows, we don't really know where the first area of support is going to be. On the Nasdaq 100, having gone through 1500, and on the future, the September future is currently sitting at 1476, the first area of roundophobic numbers would be 1400. That's not a prediction, but that's the first area of potential support. So what we will probably see is the reverse of the Wall Street leash effect, and I'll explain what that is for the new subscribers that are coming in all the time. And that is that when the US is steady to rising, it leaves out liquidity, and people in search of return will bet on high beta markets, which means that US investors will start to invest abroad in non-US denominated sectors. And that gives a boost, which is followed up very quickly by just about everybody else, to just about every stock market around. And as liquidity is poured out, those markets can run on the upside. And of course, liquidity just doesn't just find its way into the stock market, but it finds its way, and has certainly found its way, into the commodity markets over the last couple of years, and into the government bond market. However, when the US is contracting and that liquidity starts getting pulled back in, then that pulls the leash back in on all those markets that had risen on a sea of liquidity, and the ones that don't have the good fundamental stories will get left high and dry. So we saw some of those Middle Eastern markets getting pulled back very, very significantly because they were rising on a sea of liquidity. Now, that liquidity needn't necessarily have been coming from the excess money supply in Europe and Japan and in the US. I mean, that a lot of people are attributing that the rise in the Middle Eastern markets to petrodollars. But regardless of where the liquidity came from, it's certainly been pulled back. And we're starting to see more rational-minded valuations for some of those Middle Eastern markets. That's going to take a very long time, I think, before we see a major bubble like that seen in Saudi Arabia recently, in the near future. And for that to happen, we would have to see the government starting to pour enormous amounts of that petrol money into the economy, or into the stock market in particular. And I'm not at all sure that's going to happen. But the point being is that the countries and the markets that have a very, very good fundamental story will hold up reasonably well in the downdrafts, and then they will accelerate remarkably well in when liquidity starts to get pumped out again. And we're starting to see that now. I mean, India, for example, had a remarkably good uptrend for the last couple of years when liquidity was abundant. But since it's been pulled back in, it's come back sharply, and that there's no denying that. But it certainly hasn't collapsed in the same way that we've seen these Middle Eastern markets collapse, because of that fundamental story and because that there are legitimate long-term investors who are willing to ride this out, and they're not selling. So we're in a secular bear market for equities in the US, and that is having a major impact on other equity markets right around the world. Now, the Fed are have I mean, I wouldn't take a central banker's job if it was offered to me on a plate, because well, for one thing, I don't think I'm smart enough, but the main point is that it's an incredible headache. they've got three main tools in their box. The first is that they can print money, and they've certainly been doing plenty of that. The second is that they can raise interest rates. And the third is that they can tighten credit conditions. Well, they've certainly been raising interest rates, particularly in the US. They've gone from 1% to 5.25%. But at the same time, they've been printing money at an incredible rate. And unfortunately, they don't publish the M3 figures anymore, but they do publish M3 figures just about everywhere else. And in the Eurozone, M3 was expanding at 9% per annum at the last figure, which is incredible given that GDP growth is only about 2%. And I think that's a very optimistic figure to say 2%. So there's an incredible amount of money getting pumped into the system. People talk a lot about how much liquidity Japan was pumping in and how much they've taken out, and blaming the liquidity drain from Japan being the cause for the current stock market correction. And I think there's certainly an amount of truth in that. But Japan certainly isn't the only central bank that was pumping liquidity in, and it probably isn't the only one that has taken some liquidity out. And the reason that we can say that is because no one currency in the world has massively appreciated. Because if there was just one central bank in the world was not creating liquidity at the same rate as all the others, then that country's currency would appreciate remarkably fast. And because we haven't seen that, it means that pretty much all central banks are printing money at more or less the same rate, which shows very clearly when you look at the reasonably long-term charts of the main currency pairings, because the vast majority of them are in a lateral range. So what this means is that we've become addicted to liquidity in the markets, and liquidity started getting pumped in back when we had the long-term capital management, and we had the Asian financial crisis and the Russian debt default, and then there was a Mexican currency, there was Argentina, and there was Y2K, the busting of the tech bubble, 9/11, and all of these were excuses to pump liquidity into the system. So credit has been expanded at an incredible rate. So where does this leave us in terms of what our money is worth? Unfortunately, not very good, because in this world of fiat currencies, and every country is printing money really like there's no tomorrow. It's almost like Iago, when he said, I think it was Iago in Othello, who said, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." Because central banks are coming out and they're saying, with incredible humbug, that they're tackling inflation. But when the ECB is printing money at nearly 9% a year, they're certainly not tackling inflation. And that leads us into one of our main investment themes for the decade and possibly more, and that is the rise in precious metals. Because as the currency loses value, it means that people are going to start putting a store of value in hard assets. And you can certainly see that in the chart library when you look at gold in 26 different currencies. You can see that gold is making new highs in some of them, but has certainly broken out of a base in the last year and is appreciating relative to just about every currency. Now, that means that we have an enormous amount of liquidity in the system. And of course, one of the main points for the stock market is that you look at the Dow Jones and the S&P, and then you look at what happened to Japan after its bubble burst in 1989-90. Well, Japan collapsed, and the Dow is pretty close to its all-time highs, and the S&P isn't that far off them either. And that difference is liquidity. So while the amount of liquidity that's been pumped into the system is certainly very important, we can't really condemn our central bankers for putting it in there, because it is certainly helped protect the financial markets. But That's by the by. The one of the important facts is that of markets, Japan has been in a bear market for well since 1990, so 16 years. I think it entered that bear market in 2003, broke up from its base last August, and we can certainly say that the Nikkei will reach its all-time highs well before the Nasdaq ever reaches its highs. So Japan is entering a new bull market, and this normalization of the interest rates is a very positive step along that road. Now, moving back into to look at gold, there's when you look at the gold price in particular, it hit $750 a couple of months ago. It's certainly in a corrective phase now. But the chances of us looking back at $750 in 10 years' time and thinking that it was small beans is really quite high. And the same goes then for the other precious metals like silver, platinum, and palladium. Platinum in particular has more of an industrial use, so there's a good fundamental story behind an actual use for platinum in the world apart from investment, whereas gold is really just for has limited industrial uses compared with the amount of supply out there. The other main concern here is our government bonds. And when you look at the long-term charts of government bonds, when Paul Volcker came into the Fed in 1980, government bond yields were in the teens. And well, he rose interest rates so high that they got very quickly into the teens to fight against inflation. Now, inflation was killed off at that point, and they were beating it to death for nearly a decade afterwards. But right now, after you had this enormous bubble in the US and the absolute terrifying fear that we were going to see a similar bust to that in Japan, they were afraid of deflation. And because they were afraid of deflation, they dropped interest rates to rock bottom levels and left them there for really rather a long time, which means that you had remarkably low yields. And there was, I remember last year you had m fantastic realizations, ra sorry, not realizations, rationalizations, that government bonds were never going to go down in price. But right now we've seen government bonds come down for the last 2 or 3 months. You've had 10-year yields pushing back up again above 5%, and the chances are that they're probably not going to fall very much below that anymore. We are in a new inflationary cycle. Even though they were afraid of deflation, deflation has been killed off. And even though they might still be afraid of deflation, inflation is starting to hit the headlines. Now, inflation is certainly not something that central bankers want, particularly because they're stoking it on the sly, and they'll have to be seen to do something about it by the public, which they have been doing by raising interest rates pretty much across the board. I think 20 central banks around the world have raised interest rates in June, rose interest rates in June, I should say. So that's definitely central bankers trying to do something to ward off the public being very alarmed by inflation. But we can be certain that once they can claim some sort of Pyrrhic victory over inflation, and that may not be right around the corner because we have commodity prices starting to push back up again. The sooner that they can claim that Pyrrhic victory over inflation and they can start to drop interest rates, that is going to help support the stock markets really very well. And that could be the key to some very, very good returns in 2007, 2008. But that brings us to the one of the I suppose the theme we talk about most in Fuller Money is supply and elasticity meets rising demand, because central bankers are, and oil companies for that matter, are betting on lower commodity prices in the future. But this is being a new inflationary cycle, and inflationary cycles generally coincide with commodity super cycles. The chances of us seeing very low industrial commodity prices over the next decade and more are really very low. There's only so much oil in the world, and there are 5.5 billion people in the emerging markets who aspire to the standard of living that we have in the Western world or in the developed world. And there's not really nothing that they're going to stop at to attain that standard of living. Implied in that is that per capita use of oil is going to skyrocket. And we're starting to see that now in India and China and across Asia. Well, what that means is that even though we haven't really found very much new oil, the demand for oil is remorseless in its advance. So the chances of us seeing low oil prices again are practically nil unless there is some incredible scientific discovery, which there doesn't seem to be any major sign of right now. So that means oil is going up, and even though oil is probably the most political of all commodities, it's in a very steady uptrend. It's choppy within that uptrend, but it has a rivetingly consistent progression of rising lows. So with that, unless that's broken, we can be reasonably sure that oil is going to continue going up. And if it stays as steady as it is now, that means we're going to see a $10 to $15 rise every year until we see some sort of acceleration. Acceleration in oil would really not be the most welcome thing, because it would, for anyone who's long of this particular sector, because it would harbor an end to this remarkably consistent uptrend. Just one second, I need to cough. Excuse me. So, we have oil and the energies moving up. But because of this 5.5 billion people aspiring to our standard of living, you have an incredible building boom going on, and China has certainly been hitting the headlines over the last 5 or 6 years for the amount of building that they're doing. But you look at some of the areas in the Middle East, particularly Dubai, and the incredible building that they're doing. And then you look at India, where the demographics are simply beyond belief, and they have to create millions of extra residences in the next couple of decades just to stand still. So, with the amount of building that's going on and the amount of jobs that need to be found for all these young people, the demand for industrial resources is going to be going up and going up and going up. And when we look at any of these fundamental analyses that predict that we're going to see average prices, for example, of 15,000 for nickel in 2006, they're pretty much pie in the sky. Because why would you have an average price so far below today's price? That implies that you're going to have a collapse, that prices are going to fall well below your average to create the average in the first place, particularly when we're 7 months through the year already. So the chances are that because we've got so much demand coming in from the emerging market, and not demand just in the short term, but demand over the very long term, it means that the secular bull market in commodities is here with us to stay, that it is going to be a fuel for inflation over the longer term, which means we are going to see rising interest rates. But of course, nothing goes up in a linear fashion. And the chance, what we're going to see are rolling waves of inflation scares where central banks are then forced to act. And then we see the fear starting to subside, and liquidity starting to get pumped back into the system, which in the end starts to fuel inflation again, which leads to the next inflationary scare. This means that we're going to see higher commodity prices, we're going to see higher government bond yields, we're going to see equity markets expand rapidly, those that are in bull markets during the times when liquidity is pushed out, but contracting probably quite violently in the inflationary scares. And we're really in one of those right now. And we can see that the ones that are in secular bear markets are contracting faster than those that are in relative bull markets. Now, of course, this has ramifications for currency prices, but because particularly the reserve currencies and the reserve currency central banks are printing so much money, you're not going to see massive or very long term. You wouldn't see very long term trends in currencies anyway, but you're not going to see very big trends in the reserve currencies relative to each other, simply because none of those central banks wants a strong currency. One of the more interesting charts is the Asian dollar index, where you can see Asian currency starting to appreciate relative to the dollar. That's primarily because of Japan, which is quite a, sorry, not Japan, China, which is quite a large weighting in there, but also you've got Singapore and Korea, which are appreciating relative to the dollar, and those are probably the best of the currency plays around. Now, excuse me, before I lose my voice entirely, I'm going to sign off, and thank you very much for your time, and I hope you have a very good weekend.